Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Slurms Matt Court. How you doing?
I'm well, sir. Yourself?
Not bad. Eugene, Oregon, hosted the World Athletics Championships at Hayward Field, one of many elite premier athletics events. This one is sort of like the Olympics, but it's not the Olympics. It was a hell of a competition. The United States did very well. The Ducks were represented not just on the U.S. team, but for countries around the world. You wrote a pretty comprehensive article about how this competition went. I really enjoyed reading it. It's up on Addicted to Quack right now. What are your personal takeaways from the event?
Yeah, thanks very much for the compliment. I was really impressed by it because it is run in a similar fashion to what the Olympics are like, where you've got athletes from all over the world coming to your venue, and they have all the basically all the track and field events, at least, if not the greater Olympic events that they have during the actual Summer Olympics. But you have world-class athletes showing up in your town to compete for world championships. And I thought the way it was organized, things generally speaking, and we'll get into some of the glitches in a minute or two, but I thought generally speaking, the thing went off without a hitch. And you can imagine the logistical challenges that bringing in hundreds of athletes from all over the world and thousands of spectators from all over the world to Eugene to run this massive track meet, over basically 10 days, where every day something important is happening. You've got finals happening, or you've got key heats or key semifinals happening. You frequently have several events, as you do at any track meet that you attend. You've got several important events going on all at the same time, and having the crowd there to focus on them, and especially in Eugene, where you know your base crowd is going to be knowledgeable about track and field. So they're going to know when to cheer. They're going to know when to sit back and wait for something to happen. I thought the whole thing put Eugene and Oregon and track and field, frankly, in a fantastic light, by and large, with a couple of glitches, which we can talk about.
Yeah, this is the first time I believe the world have been to the United States, and you know, where else are you going to go? I mean, it's a testament to the place that Eugene and the University of Oregon hold in the world of track and field. That, like, yeah, the first time you hold an Olympic caliber event in the United States, you do it in Eugene. Where the hell else are you going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And, for an Olympic caliber event, at the Olympics, they do things like build the Olympic Village, right? They have, tons of dedicated security. They reroute traffic. They, the logistical challenges for the Olympics are legendary, to the extent that, like, several cities who you might think would want to host have, like, turned it down because they're like, we don't want those nightmares. Now, track and field is not the entirety, of the Olympics, of course, but, like, it is of that, caliber. And, you don't get to do any of that because Eugene's a college town, and they just sort of had to take it in stride in terms of, the local hotels and hospitality and, traffic control, security, et cetera. Like, this is an athletics website and podcast and not a logistics and policing one. So we won't talk about this for too long, but, like, there was a potential for an event of this nature to be a catastrophe. And instead it was the opposite. It highlighted Eugene and the University of Oregon and got a lot of press. I mean, it was coverage in the New York Times. There's an article in the New York Times this week that's essentially all about why is the World Track and Field Championships in Eugene, Oregon, and discusses the history of the University of Oregon and Steve Prefontaine and Bill Bowerman and all these, when else is this, tiny little college burg going to get covered in the New York Times? It's going to be covered
not very often. And it's also, the other thing is, it's a tribute to the people that looked at Hayward Field 10 years ago or whenever they started and said, hey, we need to work on a remodeling and upgrading of Hayward Field if we want to host international track and field meets. things, and they looked at it, and they clearly put together a venue that works, perhaps ideally, for this kind of a large international meet. And the Hayward Field has now hosted three major track meets in as many months, and everything has worked wonderfully. You haven't heard one word about
Nobody, there aren't no stories about the toilets leaking.
Exactly. And so it's I think it's a real tribute to the university and the planning that went into putting that facility into the 21st century, and opens up perhaps a new, greater phase of Tracktown USA for the University of Oregon and Eugene.
Well, it's definitely the case, you know, now we've transitioned from an athletics to a logistics to a construction podcast, but it does highlight, you know, Oregon has been in a real construction craze, you know, for the last 20 years, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a building that, you know, doesn't work, you know, that, you know, that there are problems. You know, they built an academic support center a couple of years ago, you know, where with, like, you know, if you ever walk past it, it's this glass cube, you know, right there on the corner. And, you know, I've gone inside it, and it's this palace, you know, like all these buildings are palaces.
Right.
And, you know, they don't cut corners. You know, they highlight the university, and like, this is the relationship of athletics at the highest level to an institution of higher learning, is that, you know, their advertisement for your campus, and it's important to get it right. And this is one of the many areas in which Oregon fans can be reassured and proud that, hey, their university got it right.
And
consistently does so.
To a large degree, and I think this is obvious in football, maybe perhaps less obvious in some other sports, but there's a self-stoking cycle that happens. And one of the reasons that Oregon went after the facilities building phase that it did 25 or 30 years ago is because they saw, when we visit, you know, a Midwestern college, Ohio State or Michigan, or we visit a Southeastern Conference school to play football, their facilities are just so much nicer and so much more modern and better than ours are. And so, therefore, they're getting recruits that we might have a shot at, but because our facilities aren't quite up to snuff, they might go to a different school. And I think that has really helped the school. Again, when you're in Eugene, Oregon, recruiting athletes for any sport, I'm not sure it matters which one, you want to get rid of as many objections to that high school student or that the current college athlete coming to the university as you can. And one of the things you can do is present to them facilities that are world-class or as close to world-class as you can get. And they've done this across the board with men's and women's sports in many, many instances. You look at baseball and softball, basketball, certainly, volleyball obviously plays in Mac Court as well, and with all the tremendous football facilities that have been put in, they've really done a fantastic job of making it everything a world-class experience on the athletic side. And as you note, they're not skimping on the academic side of things at the same time. And that's gratifying, I think, you know, as sports fans who may care about academics as well, to see the university put some of that effort, that same level of effort, into some of the academic facilities.
You know, famously, you know, Oregon is one of the few institutions that does not, you know, the athletic side does not take money from the academic side, or to the extent that they do, it's, you know, minor, you know, it's a token amount, you know, because essentially the athletic side is self-sustaining. And, you know, what you said about, you know, eliminate any reason for a recruit not to pick your school, like, it works the other way too. You know, we have not talked much on this podcast or on this website about, you know, potential conference realignment where Oregon may wind up in a couple of years, but like, all of those things about, you know, making yourself a world-class institution and eliminating any sort of embarrassing, you know, facilities stuff, you know, that stuff is relevant to, you know, to to the conference realignment stuff. You know, like Oregon and Washington State are not so different, right? Like their fundamentals, their, you know, structural stuff. They're both in, you know, tiny little towns and kind of the middle of nowhere. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of athletic success, you know, up until, you know, pretty recently. But then, you know, some point in the mid 90s, their paths diverge. And the major way that their paths diverge is that Oregon seriously invests in itself as an academic institution and as a athletic institution with world-class facilities like Hayward Field. You know, that's just the end point of, or the most recent of them, but that, you know, it's not, they're done. And yeah, like, you know, can you imagine the Big Ten, you know, licking its chops at getting Wazoo, you know, yeah. Hard for me to imagine. Can you imagine the Big Ten licking its chops at getting Oregon? A little easier. You know, what the hell's the difference between Oregon and Wazoo? This Hayward Field and the fact that Oregon hosts the World Athletic Championships and Pullman hosts, you know, lentil farmers or whatever.
Right.
Sorry to any Cougs fans. I enjoy your lentils and your Cougar gold, and I like a Natty Light as much as anybody else. Let's talk about some of the Ducks who competed in the World Athletics Championships. There were quite a few of them.
There were 15 that were originally scheduled to compete. A couple of those were alternates or ended up not competing. So I think we had 12 or 13 Ducks that actually competed in events. And we have a lot of excellent performances. In particular, I think I need to point out Jenna Prandini, who was the only gold medalist who was an Oregon grad or recent participant at the university. She was on the 4x100 relay team for the women, and the U.S. Went on to take the gold in that race.
Yeah, the photo you selected of those four in the relay for the header of the article was just a fantastic photo.
Yeah, they were pretty jacked, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, buddy. Those are
athletes, man. Like, and with the American flags and Hayward Field in the background, it's just like, this is a photo.
Yeah. Yeah, they really ran well. And if anybody that follows even a track and field, even tangentially, like at Olympics time, knows that one of the problems you have is in relays is the passing of the baton. It's the one thing that screws up teams more than anything else in relay sports and track. And they did a fantastic job because you can obviously, if you can get that down, you can save yourself a ton of time, even against the field or against yourself to better your own time. And they had no problems passing the baton. The men's team had some problems passing the baton and ended up not winning their race, their final, because of that. But Prandini also ran the 200. She didn't do quite as well there. She almost qualified for the final. She was like 0.03 of a second away from qualifying on time in the women's 200 meters. So she really did a fantastic job. And then just, the, you know, the other important Duck was Devin Allen that had like high visibility.
They're all important, but like,
well, they're all important, but I mean, he's the one that would have, my view, would have medaled at least, if not won the gold medal in his race, had he not been disqualified for starting too early. And this is an interesting thing because the international track has really struggled with how to figure out what to do about false starts. They've had rules in the past where there was one free false start for the field, and then the next person to false start was disqualified, which you can imagine doesn't really work very well. Well,
yeah, now there's gamesmanship potential.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, God, this other person false started too. It just was the first one instead of the second one. I'm out, and they're in. That's, you know, that is fair. So now they're using a reaction time, where if you react faster than 0.1 of a second after the gun has been fired, then you've had a false start and you're disqualified. And this is what happened to Devin Allen. I believe his reaction time was 0.09 of a second instead of 0.1 of a second.
Yeah, basically he was 0.001 of a second off.
Yeah. And here's my take on it kind of in the article and generally is, we're talking about his reaction time after the gun has been fired. Not before. He's not leaving the blocks before the starter gun has gone off.
Right. Like it's the idea after. the idea of the 10th of a second is that like that is the limit of human reaction times. Right. And that if you are moving before a 10th of a second, that means that you actually decide you got lucky and you decided to go before that you actually heard the pistol.
Right.
And so you shouldn't be rewarded for that. But like, who the hell is to say a 10th of a second is the, you know, limit of human, like maybe Devin Allen is just faster than you, you know, like how did a 10th of a second, like, is that written in the code of the human genome? Like,
I don't know. You know, at one time it was impossible for a human being to run a mile in less than 4 minutes.
Right. Exactly. Like maybe Devin Allen's just faster than you are.
And
like,
one time I heard somebody say, you know, if you could train yourself to start the race when you heard the gun fire rather than waiting until the sound stopped to start your race, you'd be the fastest runner in the world because you'd be, you know, however, a 10th of a second or whatever it is ahead of everybody else. And that, to me, that's kind of what Devin Allen has either figured out or, as you mentioned, he's timing it somehow between when they say set and the gun fires. But in any event, international track again clearly is going to have to relook at their false start.
Yeah, I mean, this just
try to figure something out.
So much
out.
Controversy.
Yeah, you know, and unnecessarily.
Yeah, like Devin Allen doesn't look like the villain here. You know,
not by a long shot. Not by a long shot.
Well, there were a bunch of other ducks who competed. We're not going to recapitulate all of them on this podcast. You should read Slurm's article. Like I said, it's very good and comprehensive. The thing that really caught my eye that we haven't talked about yet is how many of Oregon's athletes were competing for nations that weren't the United States, right? You know, Kevin Nelson competed for Jamaica and Shauna Grebo for France and Jillian Weir for Canada, Jessica Hull for Australia, Tristan James for the Dominican Republic. And Emmanuel Himeje, who I believe is Eritrean extraction. I forget. But anyway, he competes for Italy. You know, it's like about half of the ducks were, you know, because, and I want to tie that back to what we were talking about earlier, because Oregon's international institution, you know, like this isn't, you know, the best damn runner from Beaverton High School, you know, although maybe the best damn runner from Beaverton High School could compete for the Ducks. But like, it's, you know, Oregon, you know, its track and field program is, you know, of clout, and Eugene is an attractive enough location that people who are world-class athletes, like literally world-class athletes, and represent their nation at, you know, the Olympics and other world, you know, competitions are like, yeah, and I'm going to go to college in Eugene. Because,
and that's, you know, with a new track and field coaching staff, or at least a new head track and field coach coming in, who knows these athletes, international athletes, because of his work with the Bowerman Track Club, it should be obvious that it's critical to be able to find athletes who are not based in Oregon, not based in the West, not based in the United States, to come and compete for the university.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little football. All right, so this week I am going to be publishing, imagine the air quotes, listener, a compilation of my entire Duck Dive series of the entire Pac-12 as it stands today for the, you know, all the teams that are going to be on Oregon's schedule, plus a couple of teams that aren't. Oregon is not scheduled to play USC or Arizona State, but I preview them anyway for thoroughness. And hell, they could see them in the Pac-12 title game. Maybe not ASU. anyway, last week I talked, because I had wrapped it up and I wrote about Oregon and sort of naturally compared Oregon to a bunch of other teams. But like, we didn't really talk much about, you know, some of the surprises or, you know, other things about other teams. I get pretty comprehensive about them, and I figured we could take a little bit of time and, you know, talk about interesting news and notes from, you know, from this series. You know, I risk of patting myself on the back, I don't think anybody gets more comprehensive than I do, you know, in this Pac-12 series. So like, all right, Slurms, let's
hear. You know, I think, honestly,
hit my brain.
my view is most of the questions anybody would have are probably answered if they just read the articles for comprehension. So one of the things that I find interesting about your articles is you talk in almost every one of them, and perhaps in every one of them, especially this time of year, about the spring games that the schools hold. You look at, you watch them, or you look at the video after the fact, and to determine players and who's got skills and who maybe doesn't. And I was wondering if you have a sense of how, what the coaching staffs might be looking for to come out of those spring games.
Nothing. The coaching staff,
they're just throwing them out there. So I was, that's the thing. I was wondering if, you know, let's say you've got a guy who's a clear one. Okay. You know, he's, he's a beast. He's going to be your starting defensive end. Do you sit him? Do you play him with the twos or threes so you can give a somebody who's right behind him in the mix some time with the ones? Is there any strategy going on, or is it just we got a list and we're throwing these guys out there?
There appears to be a convention. I kept track of this because I was, you know, at one point I was sitting there. This years ago, I tried to figure this out because I was worried that, like, maybe there's no correlation. Maybe the ones and twos that they claim that they're putting out there in the spring game is completely unrelated to, you know, who's actually leading in the race to get the job as first stringer, second stringer, et cetera. And so I kept track of that. I did this project years ago. And what I found was, like, no, actually, the spring game ones are very predictive across multiple coaching staffs, you know, not just at the same school, but like across coaching staffs. The spring games actually are extremely predictive of what the two deep is going to be, with the exception, of course, that you don't know about, you know, potential injuries that might happen, or, you know, guys who show up on campus in the fall, you know, fall camp battles, or guys who are being held out in the spring game for injuries. But, like, basically, you know, with those sort of caveats aside, the guys who are playing with the ones in the spring game, generally speaking, you know, are going to be your first stringers, you know, come the opening game of fall. It's really, like, athletic talent just speaks for itself. It's why there's no substitute for film study. When you turn it on, you're just like, that guy is faster. That dude hits harder. That dude has more zip on his ball. You know, that dude, you know, can block. That dude can tackle. And, you know, these guys, if that guy has to be the starter, then they're in trouble. You know, that's the value more than anything else of the spring game. And the spring game itself is not really a competition. The coaches all know it. And the reason why I say that, like, the athleticism speaks for itself is it's not like that's practice 15. Like, the coaches have that sussed out by, like, practice 3, you know, like they, you know, the spring game is just a ratification of what, you know, folks already know about, you know, about where their bodies are at. You know, like, obviously, like, 247 and other scouting services give athletic, you know, reports on these kids and that, you know, what their dimensions are and what they project their talent to be. But, like, that's a high school kid and there's, you know, their bodies aren't done developing, you know. The kid, by the time that they're, you know, a junior in college compared to when they were a junior in high school, like, that's a pretty significant amount of growing, you know, in a young man's life.
Right.
So, like, you know, it's not, it doesn't completely track, you know, like the 0.89s are not exactly always ahead of the 0.86s and so forth. But, like, you know, but between the spring and the fall, there's no real changes, you know, like the athletes who are capable of playing at the Power Five level, you know, make themselves known and it's pretty obvious to watch them.
Do you, how are you feeling about, the recruiting? There's been a ton of recruiting news. It seems like just in recent, days and certainly weeks for Oregon, and the staff seems to be just picking right up where the previous staff left off as far as recruiting high-end kids. Do you expect in the current class that's either come in or will come in for the fall? Do you expect anybody to get significant playing time?
Oh, true freshman.
Yeah.
Well, I think. the class of 23 won't be here till the class of right. till 2023. Yeah, so, you know, right. But in terms of like the class of 2022, I understand your question now that the like, because that's potentially anytime there's a coaching transition, it's potentially fraught, you know, how the transition's going to, you know, in terms of the how are they going to be able to retain the kids in the transitional right. class, which is the 2022 class. So in terms of, you know, true freshmen from the 2022 class, I'm reviewing my list now, for Oregon. I mean, there are a number of transfers. You're probably excluding those. Doubt it. You know, maybe a couple as backups, but I don't think that's really your question.
I was just wondering if there's an impact player.
The only position where I think there's a chance of serious true freshman playing time is at cornerback, where I think Jaleel Florence, one of the two four-star Jaleels from San Diego, but Florence enrolled in the spring. Tucker's not going to arrive until fall. Florence was playing in the spring game, and he didn't look bad, and the position is thin enough that he might get some real playing time. Every other position for Oregon, like, I guess I'll put it this way, having done this entire series, I think Oregon has a number of true freshmen who would be pressed into service as starters or, you know, heavily in the rotation at most other Pac-12 schools because of the nature of their talent voids. But Oregon enjoys a position, you know, due to good recruiting for the last, you know, four cycles, where that's really not the case for, you know, like they're, you know, so for example, Devin Jackson and Harrison Taggart are inside linebackers who both enrolled early in the spring. They're both four stars. I saw them in the spring game and they look good. That, you know, they're, you know, they look like they're Power Five caliber players. Mm-hmm. And I think at any other school in the Pac-12, just about any other school, you know, they would probably be getting serious playing time, but they walk into Oregon's ILB room. You know, they're not displacing as true freshmen Noah Sewell and Justin Flo and, you know, Jackson LeDuc and Jeffrey Buss and Keith Brown. Like, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen, guys. You know, you're going to redshirt this year, you know, as well you should. Like, that's how the big boy programs do, you know, like, you know, I can tell you from having done all this study on, you know, Ohio State and Georgia and you know, all the, you know, big boy programs that I've been studying in recent years, Oklahoma, you know, like, yeah, that's their structure. You know, like you get four stars, but there's a bunch of four stars ahead of them. So they redshirt, which is like, yeah, that's what you want. Like,
sure.
And like, that wasn't exactly like, you know, Mario Cristobal followed up Willie Taggart and Mark Helfrich, and Mario Cristobal would recruit dudes who, as true freshmen, were better than the guys that he inherited from the previous right. staffs. And so, and Mario Cristobal, I think, to his credit, reasonable people can disagree on that, but you know, it's my opinion that like that's the right way to do it. You put your best dude on the field and it doesn't matter whether, you know, the sort of like, well, he's earned his dues or, you know, we're rewarding his loyalty to the program. Like, nah, I'm sorry. That doesn't fly with me. You know, you put your best dude on the field. Now Dan Lanning is not walking into the same situation that Mario Cristobal walked into. Dan Lanning is walking into a situation where he can recruit four-star true freshmen and redshirt them because they're, at least at this moment in their development, not the best available player. It's a good position to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Do you so are the changes or the new again in air quotes defense that Oregon's going to be implementing, is it different enough from what they've been playing and the players that they have that they could have some adaptation issues at a position or two? Or are they similar enough that it's not going to, then the kids are athletic enough and smart enough that they'll just adapt to it?
Yeah, the latter. They're playing Dan Lanning's defense is essentially a three down, two ILB, five defensive back, you know, system. That's what Oregon has been using since Jim Leavitt and Andy Avalos and Tim DeRoot are all using that. You know, are their defenses a little different? Yes, but they're structurally, you know, they use those same things, and so they're these jobs all map onto the new, you know, the you don't have to, you know, wonder about like, oh, how do you convert that guy into a four? He was supposed to be a four. Like, how do you convert that guy into an inside linebacker? Like, he was supposed to be an inside linebacker. Like, whereas, you know, with a bunch of other programs in the Pac-12, you know, they go back and forth. You know, Arizona is changing its, it will now have undergone four different 3-4 to 3-4, you know, down lineman fronts, yeah, you know, in as many years. You know, Colorado is sort of messing around with a bunch of different things, although I think that Colorado basically has figured out that like their defensive coordinator, Chris Wilson, I think he wants to run a 4-3, but he knows that he didn't inherit the right talent for it. And so wisely is just going to run, you know, the right, you know, defense, you know, instead of what he wants to do. So, you know, good for him, but that's like the temptation was there. You could see it. You know, other places, like for example, Oregon State and Stanford, you know, they are structured to run a three down front. They recruited, you know, the other, you know, linemen that they have to be in a three down front, but then they don't have nose tackles for, you know, variety of reasons that are explored in the articles. But like the upshot of that is that like they effectively wind up playing a two down front because they don't have the third man, you know, they don't have the dude in the middle. And, yeah, and like, you know, these, like I said, they're explored in the article, but it's sort of like, you know, these guys, like Oregon State fired its defensive coordinator last year. And I'm not here to like defend Tim Tibisar's honor or anything. He was the defensive coordinator who got fired. And I'm not here to tear down Trent Bray. He was the inside linebacker coach who got promoted to be the new defensive coordinator. But I do think that like, you can't like that was a failure of recruiting and retention and to some extent luck. Like that defense stunk because all of their nose tackles transferred out and, yeah, and they didn't have anybody else ready to go. They may now, like they sort of look like they're getting some dudes back from injury. And so that they may be, you know, okay at that position going forward. But like, you know, they were essentially sort of like forced into a scheme change that they couldn't, you know, operate because they didn't have the personnel for it. This is one of the dangers of being a, you know, program that recruits like Oregon State does. Stanford, I don't know what their excuse is. You know, they've got, I'm not kidding about this, three scholarship defensive linemen. Like it's just, it's nuts to the extent that they have officially declared that they are making a scheme change to a four down front. It is not, they're lying about it. It's a two down front with OLBs who are not edge players. They're too light for it. They are not going to be able to play the appropriate, what you would expect out of an end in a four down front. It's effectively going to be a 2-4-5, but guess what? Their defensive linemen are not two down, you know, guys, you know, they're not the like enormous dudes. Like Washington under Pete Kwiatkowski ran a 2-4-5, and look at the dudes that they recruited. They recruited enormous dudes like Greg Gaines and Tuli Lotulianga-Sanoa, and the other linemen they would get with guys like Levi Onwuzurike, who'd be like, you know, inside interior pass rushers and disruptive dudes. Like Washington, you know, for a couple of years anyway, recruited appropriately for a two down front. Stanford hasn't been recruiting for a two down front. They definitely haven't been recruiting for a four down front. They've been recruiting for a three down front, but then they forgot to recruit anybody and everybody left. Like, you know, so, you know, those are schools. UCLA is undergoing a scheme change to a four down front. They don't have the personnel for it. I don't understand why they made the hire that they did. That was absolutely, you know, flipping bonkers. USC is going from Todd Orlando's defense to Alex Grinch's defense. They're similar enough, I guess. Their problems won't stem from that scheme change. Utah hasn't changed schemes in a decade. Washington is undergoing sort of a scheme change. We'll see how that works out. They definitely don't have exactly the right type of guys there. Let's see. Wazoo is obviously sticking with Jake Dickert's scheme. I actually think Jake Dickert, the way that he executed the scheme change from the craziness with Tracy Clay's and his departure at the end of Mike Leach's tenure to what Jake Dickert wanted to do, I wouldn't have thought a four down front would work with the speed defense, but it actually does. And Jake Dickert should get all the credit for having smoothly executed that transition. And I think it's what won him the job. That Nick Rolovich being a crazy COVID truther. So, you know, hats off to him. I think I sort of ran through everybody there. To recapitulate, there are schools that are going through scheme changes that do not have the appropriate, you know, personnel for it, and they're going to encounter problems. There are teams that are not undergoing scheme changes, and so therefore they're going to continue to be, you know, about what you expect. And then there are teams like Oregon who are technically undergoing scheme changes, but not really. And so they should be fine. And given that they've recruited very well and they're very deep and well-experienced, that the answer at long last year question is no, there shouldn't be any problems in that
regard. Okay. Good to know. Is the, the reason we've talked a little bit about, I think this about this on previous podcasts about why you would make a choice to switch to a defensive alignment for which you don't have the personnel available to be successful. And I think the conclusion we came to is that that's what the coaching staff is capable of coaching. And you can tell that you have a higher quality coaching staff if they can coach a defense that fits the personnel that they have. If they come into a situation like the ones you're talking about, where you, in some cases you've got a new coordinator who's coming into a school, and others you have somebody that's being promoted and perhaps being asked to make a change in the defensive scheme. So it really comes down to you're doing what you know at some of these schools, as opposed to doing what might work best, although I suppose in some of these cases it wouldn't matter. You don't have the personnel to play any scheme.
You know, that's
our friends up the road there, probably both of our friends up the road, from Eugene and up the road from Portland, probably are in that ballpark.
At some point your talent just sort of betrays you. That's true. I don't really think, well, no, that's not true. I was going to say, I don't think Washington's talent has betrayed them, but then I remember that their cornerback situation is just like, I mean, it's astonishing. It is absolutely astonishing what happened to their cornerback room. They went from a ton of blue chip NFL first round cornerbacks to, I'm not joking about this, they're probably going to play two walk-ons at cornerback, you know, this year. It's like the talent vacuum that happened in Seattle this offseason and the offseason prior, the Jimmy Lake years. And Jimmy Lake was their DBs coach. Like, that's right. The thing that's so, like, mind-blowing about the situation. Like if this were last week, when discussing Cam McCormick's potential comeback, I said, like, you would throw your – if this were a movie, you'd throw your popcorn at the screen because, like, yeah. Oh, this is too corny. Like, if this were a movie – And you said, okay, so the plot of this movie is that we promoted a DB coach to be the head coach, and then he destroyed their DB's room. Everybody like, that doesn't make any sense. You got to rewrite that script, man. No one's going to buy that. Like, but like, here we are in reality where that happened, you know, like right. it's insane. You know, it extends beyond the defense too. Like this happens on the offense. So I was just praising Chris Wilson at Colorado for I think, you know, being sensible about what defensive scheme he's going to run given, you know, what talent he's got. I don't think the same can be said for Colorado on the offensive side of the ball, where Carl Durrell probably wisely fired his, you know, offensive coordinator because their offense was terrible. I mean, like world historically terrible. It was one of the worst offenses in the history of Colorado. college football, not just last year, but like the scope of advanced stats being collected. But then he replaced him with Mark Sanford Jr., who was Minnesota's coach or Minnesota's coordinator. And like anybody, even like casual college football fans could tell you the biggest problem with Colorado's offense last year was their offensive line just stunk to high heaven. Mm-hmm. And so what does Durrell do? He hires Mark Sanford Jr., who's running like jumbo. So like Oregon fans should probably be passingly familiar with what Minnesota's offense looks like, because they must have all watched the Minnesota versus Ohio State game that was immediately prior to the Oregon versus right. Ohio State game. I mean, I know I did. I wrote a whole article about it, you know. But like, I'm sure that a lot of Oregon fans watched that game, or maybe they watched the Minnesota versus Colorado game out of like Pac-12 solidarity, although they probably turned off that game after about 20 minutes because Minnesota was absolutely destroying Colorado. So like, that must be the reason why Carl Durrell is just like, oh, this offense is the one that I want. So like, what's his name? The Minnesota coach whose name is escaping where you're at right now. He used to be a wide receiver for Western Michigan, or not Western Michigan. It was some MAC team. Whatever. Anyway, he fired Mark Sanford because his offense sucked. And like, it was this jumbo, you know, like six offensive linemen, you know, power running. Oregon got the bet, you know, got Marquise Irving out of that. You know, he was their running back who played the most games for them, and like extremely sturdy, right? Like he carried the ball 133 times from Minnesota's power rushing offense that was like 3 yards in a cloud of dust. This is just like, this is like in my article about Colorado, the last line of the offensive section of that article was like, I fear for the safety of this team. They do not have adequate offensive line personnel, really, to your point, to run any offense, but definitely not this offense. Like, this is 180 degrees the opposite of the offense that you want to run. Why would you get, you know, so what do I do when I turn on the Colorado spring game? What do I see someone who's like had this, you know, am I watching somebody who's had the light bulb go on and they're like, oh, I can't run this. I need to figure out, you know, better things to do. I better go to a bunch of coaching clinics and learn how to run a different offense, because we're going to get creamed if I try to run Minnesota's offense at this, you know, institution with this personnel. Is that what I see, Slurms? Do you think that's what I saw?
I think it's very unlikely.
No, I did not. I saw Mark Sanford running Mark Sanford's offense. And like, look, I've seen Mark Sanford run good versions of that offense. He coached Notre Dame and at Boise and at Minnesota. And they're like, if you've got the personnel for it, there's a reason why, even though that offense is like starting to get kind of long in the tooth and some people think it's outdated, there's a reason why a bunch of coaches run it. Because if you have the right personnel for it, that is a dominating offense where you can just suffocate your opponent. You know, like in many ways, football is a very complex game, but it can be cut through like the Gordian knot at times, you know. And one of the strategies to cut through the complexity of college football is if you just have like six offensive linemen who are enormous human beings, and you can run the ball 50 times a game and get 4 yards a carry, and you can prevent the opponent from ever touching the football, except for when you have to give it to them on one kickoff, you can win games. I mean, that's basically how Navy wins games, and right. Army and you know, other teams. Like, it's a viable offense if you have the personnel for it. But if there's one team in the Pac-12 that has, you know, like, I would be hard pressed to find any other team in the Pac-12 that is in a worse position, maybe Arizona, that is in a worse position to run that offense than Colorado. Why the hell are they going with that? Well, these are the things that I encounter when I write profiles of every Pac-12 team. This is why, you know, ultimately I tend to think the Pac-12 is in trouble, you know, not to touch too much on the big picture stuff, but like, it's because they keep doing stuff like this. This is like, right. Every time when I write one of these articles, it's just like, what are you thinking, dude? Like, you know, I write these articles for beer money and I could run your program better than you. Like, what's, you know, why are you being paid all this money? Like, yeah. And you find it up and down the Pac-12, man. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about my next project, which is Georgia's football team. All right. So putting the Pac-12 behind us, at least for a moment, the SEC is taking over the Pac-12 with Dan Lanning and Tosh Lupoy coming from Georgia and Alabama, respectively, to run Oregon's defense. Since Oregon's opener is also coincidentally, the Georgia Bulldogs, I'm going to write a separate article later in the offseason in which I discuss the actual makeup of the Georgia football team, who are the returners, what are the schemes, who have they replaced their coaches with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For right now, the article that I'm going to be, writing the week after next is about like the structure of the Mint front. And so, it's like the schematic and philosophical sort of stuff. But I'm reviewing Georgia's film in order to get it. So that is why we're talking about Georgia football right now.
Indeed, they provide a test, I would say, and I'll be very interested to see if Oregon implements basically the same defense that Lanning was running at Georgia with a different defensive coordinator, and what changes might be needed due to personnel, if there are any, in Oregon's scheme going forward, and how the kids adapt to whatever the changes might be going forward into the fall.
I can't be certain about that. I am very curious about those questions too. If I had to make a guess right now, and my guess is also infused with my hope because I hope this is the case. I think the answer is no, not really. I don't think there are going to be many changes. I think they do have the appropriate personnel to run the defense that, that looks like what Georgia was running last year and what Tosh Lupoy was running when he was the coordinator at Alabama in 2018. They come off the same system. Essentially, the Mint front is, as they call it, is an adaptation of the tight front, which, was popularized by guys like Dave Aranda and Todd Orlando, and made its way to Tim DeRuiter's defense. At some point when he was the Fresno State coach, which is where he was at before Cal hired him in 2017, he made the transition from being a 5-0-5 guy, meaning a three down lineman, which is a five technique, which is means lined up directly over the tackle, and then a zero technique, which means a nose, lined up over the center, and then another five technique, lined up over the other tackle. He move those guys inboard to be four eyes, meaning in between the tackle and the guard and shaded to the shoulder. That's what the eye means. So it's a 4-I-0-4-I. That's a tight. And the point of that is that the nose tackle is two gapping, right? He controls the center and he controls both of the A gaps. And that guy needs to be really, really big, right? Cause he's got to be able to control two gaps at once. And then the two ends, we call them ends because they're on the end of the line. They're built like tackles. You want those guys to be about 280 or so. Their job is just to plug the B gap. That is the gap between the guard and the tackle. And the philosophy behind the tight front is, in terms of controlling the run, it's a spill and kill philosophy, right? So the idea is, going up against spread offenses, which is pretty much what anybody, plays anymore, that you just won't let them have any inside runs. If you control the B, the A, the other A, the other B gaps with three linemen, then all of your runs have to go through the C gap or the D gap or farther, outside. And the idea behind a spill and kill is that the outside linebacker, the inside linebacker, the safeties, essentially all these other guys can play off a bit. They can play back like they're playing the pass. And then as soon as they're confirmed that it's going to be a run, well, the running back, he can't get through the middle. It's too gummed up. So he's got to spill, to the outside. The linebackers are not immediately there to the outside. They're not there waiting for them. That's sort of the trick. That's where you're getting a little extra advantage here, is the linebackers are sort of backed off to play the pass. And because the running back has to take some extra time to spill out, that gives your linebackers and safeties time to come down on that outside run. But, while he's still moving east-west, you have time to come down before he turns the corner to go north south. So that, you know, that's the tight front in a nutshell. And then, you know, the variation that sort of gets invented at Alabama when Nick Saban and Kirby Smart, who was Nick Saban's defensive coordinator at Alabama for a time, what they come up with, they make a variation on the tight front. They wind up calling it the mint front. I'm sure this is some reference to Southern cuisine. I have no idea where that terminology comes from. And honestly, most college football terminology just seems like completely random and are probably named after hamburgers because these guys are inventing them at 2 a.m. But anyway, the variation basically has to do with where you align the OLB and the nickel, whether it's boundary field or whether or not you do it based on the passing strength. And, you know, so the it was one of the things that I actually picked up and is going to go into my theory article about the mint front is like one of the ways that you can actually you can kind of like leverage a little something something against this defense is if you use an unbalanced formation to the boundary, meaning you put like four potential receiving options, so like a running back, a tight end, two wide receivers to the boundary, then the mint front's going to line up the nickel to, you know, the boundary, and you're going to leave the field where the only people who are defending the field are an outside linebacker and the field safety. So if you can run into that big open grass, like you can get a little something that way. Clemson got a couple of runs that way. That's sort of the, you know, the basic idea that it's an evolution of the tight front. I tend to like the mint a little bit better because I think it makes more sense to align to the passing strength because the whole point of this philosophy is the pass can kill you more than the run. In fact, like Georgia was, you know, excellent against the run, even though they were sort of, you know, allowing isn't the right word. It's more like you only have 11 guys. You picking your defensive scheme is picking what you are going to defend the least well. And, you know, the particular thing that they defend the least well are a certain types of runs. And they've just basically made the calculation that, like, that's the, if you're going to be vulnerable to something, that's the one that can do you the least amount of damage. So that's the optimal way to do it. I think they're probably right, in, you know, judging the way that modern college football has gone. You know, I'm definitely much more worried about, you know, lining up two tight ends to the boundary and then confusing the safety about it. You know, the safety linebacker exchange. I'd rather have an extra man that side. That kind of makes sense to me. But anyway, that's, you know, the thing that's remarkable, you know, in my preliminary charting is that like Georgia's, according to advanced statistics, this was the best defense in the history of college football. It is largely driven by their talent, in particular their defensive line. Their defensive line was just lights out, just astonishing. Nobody could stop them. And it's not like I want to say that the scheme didn't matter. Obviously it did. You put the kids in a position to succeed, and like the play calling matters and the simulated pressures and the blitzes and, you know, when you play up and when you play back, like all of these things matter, but you're not going to get any of that done without defensive linemen who just wreck the offensive line. And that's what they were doing. And here's the other, the thing that's sort of remarkable about this talent, it is a very talented team, is that like, they're not superhuman and they're not robots. They're 19-year-old kids who make mistakes. Like every single play, like I give grades to every single, you know, all 11 kids who are on the field. Like I'm hard pressed to find a single play that Georgia did in which there were all 11 kids, you know, no notes. Everything right. That you did was perfect. Like they're screwing up. They screw up all the time. They're kids, you know, it's that A, the number of screw-ups are fewer than other teams. B, the number of the screw-ups are less impactful because they're so talented that like you can make up for it. And C, that the scheme has sort of layers of redundancy. So like oh, the pass rush didn't get home. Well, that's okay. The coverage will be good. Oh, the coverage wasn't good. Well, it didn't matter because the pass rush got home. Oh, the pass rush and the coverage, you know, had some problems. Well, they're going to tackle really effectively. You know, the linebacker is super fast and is going to get there in time, you know, to make a tackle. So that was only a 6-yard gain. It wasn't a 60-yard gain. You know, it's like, you know, these layers of redundancy, and that's what the defensive coordinator does. And that's the thing that's like, you know, the scheme is fascinating, and I will put up clips of the simulated pressures and so forth. But the thing that really impressed me about Dan Lanning's defense more than anything else was just like, it was simultaneously professional and also recognized that these kids are kids. Like, there was no part of that scheme that was like, I guess this is another point that's sort of difficult to articulate. I'll do my best here. That, like, I've watched schemes both on offense and defense where this entire thing is dependent on this kid getting that right. And if he doesn't, we're going to give up a big play, or we're going to, you know, give up a sack if it's on the offense. And I don't see that with Georgia's defense. You know, I see like layers in redundancy where it's like, you know, if that kid screwed up, that's fine. The linebacker will be there and he'll get him. Like, it's a, you know, it's a keep the play in front of you kind of scheme. And I really like that. You know, I've watched way too many schemes that are like fragile. Is that the right word? Where it's like, if it's perfect, then it's perfect. But if it's one problem, the whole thing shatters. Like, yeah. This was a shatter resistant defense. And I think more than anything else, that's what I appreciate about it. And like, here's the thing that, you know, to sort of back up that point is, so I use a success rate based charting system. Basically I chart, you know, every play outside of garbage time, and, you know, the offense, you know, given the down and distance, has to get so many yards in order to stay ahead of the sticks. If they do that, then they succeeded on the play. If they failed to do that, then that means the defense succeeded on that play. Makes sense, right?
Yep.
So, and then this is the, you know, kids arithmetic. I add up how many successful plays you had versus how many total plays you had, and I divide the former by the latter, and that's your success rate. And what I, you know, basically find is, you know, after having done this for more than a decade for all different teams all around the country, is that average teams have a 50% success rate, excluding garbage time. Garbage time is really screws this up. I can't tell you, I cannot stress enough that the biggest difference between advanced stats and raw stats, and why advanced stats are valuable and raw stats are garbage, is excluding garbage time, because garbage time makes the stats go real wonky. But so once you exclude garbage time, that average teams perform at a 50% success rate, and bad teams get down to like 40, you know, they perform somewhere between 40 and 49, and good teams up to playoff caliber are between 51 and 60. Like, there's the swing's not that big. Like, you know, anything below 40%, and it's like, you should stop playing football. This is not for you. And anything above 60% is like world historical, you know, levels. Like, that's, the swing is not that big. It's, you know, if you run 10 plays and you succeed on 5 of them, you did an average job. If you only succeed on 4 of them, you did a bad job. If you succeed on just one more than average out of 10 plays, you're going to the playoffs. Like, I'm not joking about that. 60% is playoff caliber, right? And it's just, it's one play out of 10. That's the difference. Yeah. But anyway, so Georgia's the greatest defense in the history of college football, right? You would expect that their defensive success rate against the pass and defensive success rate against the run would be what, in the 70s or 80s, right? What would you guess that they are?
61.
Defensive rush success, 61%. Defensive pass success, 60%. Like, they're not, these aren't superhuman athletes. Yeah. And they're not guys who never make mistakes. And they're not guys who never get beat. They get beat 40% of the time.
Yeah.
But they win 60% of the time. And that means that they're the greatest defense ever. What they're really good at, what I should note that they're really, really good at, is limiting extra yardage. That was really the thing that was off the charts, like, exceptional. So the average pass, the average yards gained on a pass called passing play. I know that sounded confusing. I wanted to make sure that I'm being clear here. I am including, you called a pass and it was not completed, or you took a sack, or you, threw the ball away, or you had to scramble. You know, it's yardage on passing plays, not yardage per pass. Right. But having said that, they limited their opponents to only 5.77 yards per called passing play. The average that I tend to observe is more like 7.5 to 8. So that's really good. You know, they took off, you know, 2 full yards per play, per passing play. They limited their opponents to the number of 15-plus yard gains on their passing plays. They limited their opponents to only 12.5%, meaning on only 1 out of 8 times that their opponents called a passing play, the opponent successfully gained more than 15 yards. That's their explosive play rate. Really good is 10%. So actually giving up 12.5, that's good. 15 is average. So that's like the middle of the above average range, but it's not the best I've ever seen. So again, they are not perfect. They're not machines, you know, they're right.
What a great, as a coaching staff, what a great message to be able to deliver to your players is that we're, you know, I mean, I realize they probably do say things like, you know, we expect you to be perfect and we're looking at every play and we're going to do what you do basically, which is look for the mistake and how do we correct it. But the truth of it is that they don't have to be perfect. They can be, if the entire defense can operate at a 60 or 61% rate against the other offenses, they're going to win most or all of their games.
Yeah, it's about sustainability and consistency. Yeah. You know, like, you know, we've all seen spectacular football plays that stick in your memory for 20 years, right? Like, hell, you know, if you make a spectacular enough play, they'll play it on Autzen Stadium before every single game.
Right.
But what football is really about and winning a national championship is really about is you're going to have to play something like 800 to 1,000 snaps on each side of the ball. Can you play at a good level every single play? You know, that's the trick, and that is hard, apparently. Sure. It's not like I'm a football coach, but I can tell you apparently it's extremely hard.
Yeah,
you know, well, because there's another football team on the other side of the ball who is also trying to succeed 60% of the time. Right. You know, and forcing them, you know, that's where you see really good teams. Like, you came into my building averaging a 60% success rate, and in this game you averaged a 45% success rate. I forced you to underperform your average. That's because football is a directly competitive game, and that's what Georgia did to teams. Like, yeah.
Fascinating.
So yeah, that'll be my the theories and principles of the Mint Front is what's going to go up not this week but next week. And you know, it should be really fascinating. I will, even though I spent some time talking about, oh, it's just eye candy, you shouldn't be that fascinated by the simulated pressures and wacky blitzes, I will definitely include plenty of video clips of the simulated pressures and wacky blitzes, because hey, you know, you deserve some candy, I guess. But it will also be, you know, a fairly serious minded, you know, discussion of the strengths and weaknesses and, you know, why it was successful and how this maps onto to Oregon, which I think will be pretty well. And I think, you know, the Oregon Ducks are lucky to get Dan Lanning and this defensive system.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to it. That sounds like a real learning experience.
I hope so. That's why I write it. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Storm's been great talking to you. You got any parting words for us?
No, just go Ducks.
Always a good choice. Take care, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.